ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When Anna Ferguson was 10 years old, she went with her family to the Melbourne Royal Show and went on a roller coaster ride there with her sister and her dad. There was an accident, and after that, everything was different for Anna. For many years, she didn't understand why it was still so hard for her. Physically, she was okay, but emotionally, she was trapped feeling either angry or numb. But then, Anna chanced upon Muay Thai fighting, which had an amazing impact on her well-being and led to her studying psychology. That's how Anna got interested in what happens to our nervous systems during trauma and stress, understanding the science behind how we shut down or go into overdrive and what we can do about it. Anna is now a counsellor and mental health therapist who specialises in giving people practical tools to recover from anxiety, overwhelm and trauma. And recently, a crisis with her beloved husband Damien has meant that Anna's really had to draw on all the resources that she has to stay calm and regulated for him and their little daughter Scout. Anna is the author of The Vagus Nerve Reset, and her new book is 21 Days to a Less Anxious You. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Sarah.
Where was your family living when you were 10?
We actually had moved to Woodend. So we were about 45 to an hour out of Melbourne. And so this was like a trip. We used to go to the show every year. And so this was a very exciting year because I had had a bit of a growth spurt and I was actually able to reach the height, the minimum height to go on the roller coaster. So we'd made the trip down for this specifically.
And so who was in your family, Anna? Who was going with you to the show that day?
So it was about a whole family. It was a whole family affair. So my mum and dad and my two older sisters. So I'm the youngest of three girls.
And so you set off that day and you're finally tall enough to ride the roller coaster. What do you remember about standing in line? Anything?
I mean, I was nervous for sure, but I was also a pretty stoic kid, so I wouldn't let anyone know that I was actually scared of doing this thing that I had been so excited for. And so I just remember holding on to my dad's hand and just being like, God, I'm so excited to do this, like trying to really pump myself up to get on that ride. Because even getting strapped into the cart, I was like having second thoughts. I was like, do I really want to do this? It looks pretty scary. But I had already committed to it at that point. And that was generally my mindset, was like, you've said you're going to do something, so you have to do it. There's no backing out.
And what sort of roller coaster was it at the Melbourne show? Like, did it go upside down or what did it look like?
It wasn't that intense. It was called the Mad Max, or the Mad Mouse. Sorry, my memory's a little fuzzy sometimes. But it was probably the biggest roller coaster. And it's one of the oldest roller coasters that they have at the Royal Melbourne Show. It's a rickety old roller coaster and there's lots of dips and you're going around corners very, very quickly. And it was probably like the scariest one available. Yeah.
And so you're pumping yourself up to go on it and commit to it. Who are you sitting next to as you were getting into the roller coaster?
Yeah, so in the carts, you sat one in front of the other. So my eldest sister was behind me, and then the cart behind mine and my sister's was my dad and my other sister. So we were all kind of in a row together, but we were sitting one in front of the other. So you couldn't see the person behind you, but I was like right at the front of everybody.
And how quickly did something go wrong?
Relatively quickly. I mean, I had my eyes closed for probably most of the ride up until the point, but I had no reference point of what a roller coaster should be like. So when things started to shift in like how it was actually working, I didn't actually fundamentally know something was going wrong. So essentially the cart in front of ours went down like a big dip and it got stuck at the top of that dip. And then mine and my sister's cart went down that dip and slammed into the back of theirs. And, you know, at that point I was like, that didn't feel good, but I was very confused. I didn't quite understand, was this part of the ride? Should I be like, woo, this is fun? And it wasn't until I kind of heard my sister moaning in the background in pain that I was like, something doesn't seem right. But I had already stepped into this kind of space where I was in a dreamlike state, right? Like I was so confused. I was obviously hurt, but I hadn't realized it at that point in time. And I didn't really come to I was just confused. Why was this happening? Why aren't we moving? Why is it all, what's going on? And it wasn't until my dad climbed down and I saw his face in front of me and he goes, "Hey, you okay?" that my bubble kind of burst and I thought, oh shit, I can't breathe, right? And that was when it all kind of came crashing in. So this beautiful dreamlike state that had protected me for what felt like a really long time just burst and all this noise came rushing in, this moment of sheer panic of, I can't breathe, I can't get out, I'm completely trapped here, something is terribly wrong, but I don't know what it is. And so essentially what happened was upon impact, the seatbelt tightened around my chest. So for my sister, she was behind me. So her spine took all of that impact and she had a fractured spine. For me, it had caused kind of that blunt force trauma to my chest area. So I had a bruised heart. I ended up with a lacerated spleen, a dislocated shoulder, some broken ribs. And the real impact had impacted my heart. So the heart is basically the one muscle that can't, organ that can't repair itself. So my heart rate had skyrocketed to about 240 beats per minute, which is just kind of that end of the spectrum where you want your heart to be beating. But also I was essentially being crushed by this seatbelt.
Once your dad had managed to get out of his seatbelt and get towards you, could he take it off you? Could he release that mechanism?
No. So there was obviously a protection mechanism in place so that when things go wrong, the seatbelts don't automatically come off and people fall off the ride. So they essentially had to cut us out of the ride. And to do that, they needed to build scaffolding up to where we were because we were up quite high. And this took hours and hours. And I was kind of slipping in and out of this kind of dreamlike state over this period of time. I remember looking up and seeing a helicopter going past and being like, I wonder what they're looking at. And they were looking at us. Like, and so it was just, even now it's very fuzzy to me, right? The memory, there's certain things that are very clear and I can feel them. They're very tangible. There's other things that like the timeline of things feels very fuzzy still and foggy for me to kind of dip back into. But I do remember them passing me like the green whistle for pain relief. And I very quickly found out that I'm allergic to morphine. In the hospital, I ended up having to have my stomach pumped because I was allergic to the pain medication. So there was like a lot of firsts for me at 10 years old that I had no idea what was in store for me.
Do you remember that moment when they freed you from the seatbelt, from the carriage?
Not particularly. I do remember going down on like a slide stretcher and seeing my mum for the first time as we got into the ambulance.
Had she been down the bottom watching this whole thing?
Yeah. And so I can't imagine like the fear that she was experiencing and the sense of helplessness watching two of your children go through this. And my sister and I went in separate ambulances to hospital as well. So there was that real like, you have to go with this child and you have to go with this child. And yeah, I remember seeing my mum for the first time and like her look of worry on her face made me realize, okay, this is not good. Like, and I just remember wanting to like reassure everyone, hey, I'm fine. It's all good. I don't know what the fuss is about. Like, let's go home. What are we doing here? I want to go home.
So you weren't in pain physically?
I think my body had protected me from feeling the physical pain. So I was in that kind of dissociative state of where, and when you dip into that dissociative state, people who go through trauma, whether that's sexual abuse or impact trauma or even just emotional neglect and things like that, can dip into this dissociative state, which essentially pumps you with endogenous opioids and has a reducing of pain effect on your body. So I didn't particularly feel anything. It was more that feeling of not being able to breathe and that feeling of being trapped, like I've got to get out of here and I can't. And my body, I felt very angry at my body. I was like, you're letting me down here. I need to get moving.
What happened when you got to the hospital finally?
Yeah, so when we got to the hospital, the first thing they did was cut my very favourite jacket off of my body, which I pleaded with them not to. So I was... I was very obstinate. And so they had me in a neck brace and they were asking me all these questions and I kept nodding or shaking my head. And they were, please stop nodding and shaking your head. Just say yes or no. The confusion and the kind of frustration of like people making a big deal out of nothing was like the dominating thing that was going on for me. I was like, let me go. I just need to move. We went in for scans and I remember going into like an MRI scan for the first time in my life, that big donut, and I was scared of going in there. And I also obviously found out I was allergic to morphine. So they were like pumping me full of pain medication, to which I then had a very big reaction to. So then I had to have my stomach pumped from that to stop me from having a reaction. And then I think I eventually fell asleep in the scan and got taken up to one of the wards later that night. And that's kind of how the hospital stay started.
Did you get to see your sister soon after arriving?
No, so I didn't see my sister for a few weeks, actually. So she was on a completely different ward. I was in the heart area and she was in the orthopedics area for spinal injuries. So I didn't really know what was going on with her. I hadn't seen her. I wasn't allowed to move around that much because when I would move, my heart rate would spike. So one day my mum borrowed a wheelchair and she took me down to see my sister and we stayed for a couple of minutes. And that was basically the first time I'd seen her and figured out, hey, you're also injured. Because as a 10-year-old, you're very self-absorbed. Like, this is all about me. Why is no one coming to visit me when they're visiting her type of thing? And so it was a very disconnective experience to be so far away from one another.
How did your physical recovery compare with hers in the weeks and months after that?
Yeah, so her injuries were obviously more structural in that she basically had to learn to walk again. She had a back brace. She still experiences chronic pain to this day. And she had a much longer physical recovery than I did. On my side of things, I mean, my physical recovery wasn't fast. I think you couldn't see my injuries the same way that you could see, say, my sister's injuries. So my heart rate was the main issue that if it got too high, I was at risk of having a heart attack. And I was an extremely competitive and sporty kid. I had just gotten into like national athletics and for high jump of all the things, like I'm super short. So I was like chuffed that I had gotten into high jump. So I wasn't allowed to do anything. I wasn't allowed to go back to school like for a full day because it was too intense. And so I would go for an hour and then come home. So not only was I like physically not able to do the things that I wanted to do, but I was also removed from my peer group. So I had weird school hours. So I was like the weird kid that almost died on the roller coaster accident who also can't come to school for the whole day either because it's too much for. And, you know, my heart rate is still elevated to this day. Like my resting heart rate is still elevated. I went back to the children's hospital every year until I was 18 years old. I used to have Holter monitors and take them in school and put them in my pocket. I have all these like tabs on my chest. And that was just something that became normal for me. And I was quite resentful of it as well.
And was that because of the pressure that had been put on the heart for that sustained period? Is that what had happened physically?
Yeah. So when your heart gets damaged, especially like a bruising, it doesn't repair. Say you get a bruise on your arm, it doesn't repair in the same way. So essentially your heart muscle is going to struggle to function the same way that it has. And it takes a really, really, really long time for it to kind of adjust to this new way of functioning. So I was on medication to lower my heart rate. And also I think just it took a long time to build up like fitness in a new way so that I could exercise without it becoming overwhelming. But even still, like when I would do sports, a lot of the time my heart rate would spike and I'd try and push through it. So I wasn't overly cautious as a kid on the real ramifications that could have happened.
So there were a lot of physical impacts of this accident, but I guess they get better over time, or they're easy to discuss and point out and have a heart monitor and there's sort of evidence around them. But what about the sort of more intangible things like your character, your temperament? How, looking back, did that change after the accident, Anna?
I mean, it was immediate, right? I went from being, you know, I loved being the center of attention. I would make friends with anyone that I came across. I just loved life. I was a very energetic, very curious kid. When I had the accident, I became extremely volatile emotionally. I would cry almost immediately at anything, and I hated that. I thought it was a sign of weakness, and I just was so angry at myself for not being in control of things. I also was extremely rigid with myself. Hey, don't show that this has impacted you. Pull up your socks, keep going. Don't let anyone know that this has affected you. But I mean, it was pretty obvious that it had affected me because I was extremely angry. Like, anyone who tried to help was seen as a threat. Anyone who tried to like comfort me, I hated that. I hated the admission that something was wrong. I just felt completely disconnected from myself and my family as well, right? So I didn't have the tools, and I also didn't have the language, and I didn't have the understanding of like why now my life was so fragmented. Like, I didn't have the same flexibility that I had before. Things had to be a certain way or I would get very upset. But alongside that, because I was feeling disconnected and numb, I also would push the boundaries a lot with my family. Like, I would sneak out, I would go out at night, I would not go to school, I would do all of these things to kind of feel something and to feel like I did have some control over my life.
So despite all this, or with all this, you managed to make it through high school. What were things like for you by the time you were 19, Anna?
Yeah, I mean, surprisingly, I did very, very well at school. I was always someone that could show up, do the tests and do very well. And I was always, I guess I kind of used that to my advantage to skate through and not go detected in getting in trouble. But by the time I was 19, I didn't particularly know what I wanted to do. I'd started two different uni degrees at that point. And I used to catch the tram along the same street, and there was a gym that I would go past every day. And one day I looked at it, I go, you know what? Punching people actually seems like a very fun thing to do. But I was extremely, it was a very masculine, male dominated sport. And so for a long time, I was like, no, don't go in there. But for whatever reason, one day I was like, you know what? I'm going in there and I'm going to book in a trial class. So I went in.
What was it like when you walked in the door?
You know, again, I had the same mentality. No, you've made this decision. You have to follow through. And in some sense, this has served me in life because I do continue to push through discomfort. But I showed up to my first class, and I barely made it through the warm-up, which was like 3 minutes of skipping and then some shadow boxing and stuff. And I'd never thrown a punch before. So I was just doing my thing, just trying to like get through it. But by the end of the session, after doing some pad work and my coach had showed me how to throw a punch properly, and I just, for the first time, I felt this sense of stillness. It was very brief, but I just felt this sense of stillness in my body for the first time in almost a decade, where I was just like, whoa, like that feels really good not to be in this state of constant tension and combativeness and looking at what's next. It's like this moment of just like pausing and reflecting and feeling that I just did that hard thing and it was hard, but I got through it. And now my body feels relaxed of all things after doing some high intensity sport. And so that was kind of the first inkling that I had that there was maybe something here that was powerful. I didn't know it at the time, but I knew that I loved Muay Thai. So I kept going back and I started doing jiu-jitsu. I started doing MMA and I started fighting. And I actually went overseas to Thailand.
Well, tell me about this, because as you say, you're a petite, small woman. What is it like to fight MMA?
It's intense, you know. And it's an interesting thing because I came into the sport at the time where it wasn't big for women. So there wasn't many of us, which is a good thing and a bad thing. So, I mean, like I was very skinny. So I was low weight. So I could cut down weight and be much taller than some of the other girls that I was fighting against. But it was fun. It felt functional. It felt real. It felt like I could defend myself. It felt like that combative energy that I had within me had a place to go that was really healthy and it had an outlet. And I was surrounded by people, men who I had maybe put in a like dangerous space in my mind, don't interact with men. These men would all look after you, and there was a real community in that space. And it was the first time that I felt included, right? At school, I always felt like I was on the outside. I wasn't a cool girl. I didn't have like a big friendship group. But at the gym, it didn't matter what you looked like, who you were, where you've come from. Everyone rallied around you, right? Especially when you were fighting, they'd all help you cut weight, they'd help you train. It was just this group mentality where everyone was in it together. And I think that sense of connection was probably just as healing as the physiological, physical side of things too. But it was terrifying. Like, I actually...
I was going to say, what about getting hit?
I mean, that part...
This is not just working out. You're actually going to fight someone who's trying to hurt you.
You know what's funny? I mean, you get used to getting punched. It's not that painful. I hate getting kicked. I don't like getting kicked. And I would never check a kick. So when you bring your leg up so that someone doesn't kick you, I mean, I was terrified of checking a kick in case I broke my shin bone. So I'd just take kicks. But the actual pain of the physicality of it wasn't the scary part, right? It was the mindset of getting into a ring. Like, I'm not a mean person and I don't ever want to harm anyone else. So that switching into like, okay, like we have to go to combat with another human being who is also doing the same dance that we're doing in our mind. But I think that's where I kind of fell down a little bit in fighting is that my physicality, my body, everything, I was very fit. I was trained to do what I needed to do, but mentally I did not have the tools to handle the kind of extreme overwhelm of stress of getting into the ring to handle the person in front of me. And that was kind of like my downfall in that I didn't enjoy it in the way that it became so terrifying to do that. That I'd be throwing up beforehand, I'd be crying, shaking. And at that time, I was like, oh, something's seriously wrong with me if I can't do this. Now in hindsight, I'm like, oh, it makes sense.
Makes sense.
But at the time, I wasn't educated on what that was actually going through.
You even spent some time living in Thailand and training as a fighter.
Yeah, and I got sponsored by a gym over in Thailand. I was like, right, I'm going to be a professional fighter. I'm going to go over there. I trained for about 8 or 9 months. And yeah, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I loved training, I think, more than I actually liked fighting. And I actually ended up in Singapore before a fight. And I went to a bookshop and I found a book on the shelf that had a very interesting graphic. And it was called Acid Test. And it was the first book I'd seen on MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. And I read this book in like a day and I was like, that's it. I've figured out how to heal trauma. Like, I'm going to go and study psychology and become an MDMA-assisted psychotherapist so I can help other people. And so I kind of quit training and doing all of that stuff. I went and studied psychology, which I was very disappointed by. I was like, where's the psychotherapy that we got?
Lots of stats and labs or...
Yeah, I mean... For me, I had been to therapists for a decade. I'd done the whole talking about what had happened to me. I can tell my story till the cows come home. It really doesn't impact me emotionally anymore. And so I think what I found when I was studying psych was like, yeah, but what's next? Like, for the people that can tell their story, for the people that talking about it isn't fundamentally that helpful, like I never left a session being like, God, I feel light. I always left a session being like, I've told my story again and I've looked at it from a different perspective again, but I still don't feel any different. And so I got quite frustrated with psychology in that I was like, I'm learning the same tools in which I felt like didn't particularly help me. And so I started to reflect on what were the things that had helped me. So I knew that movement had helped me. I'd gained a sense of space in my body to start to look inwards without it becoming overwhelming. There was a lady that came in one day to do a lecture and she was talking about the gut microbiome and its impact on mental health. And this was the first time I'd heard this. I was like, whoa, like that's insane. No one's told me what I eat can impact how my mental health functions. So I had two pieces now. I started to use movement and I started to look at my gut health. I changed my diet. I changed the way I did things and I started to feel different, right? So I was starting to piece together a bit of a strategy. And then once I'd finished my psychology degree, I went on to become a counselor. But I also started to look at the things outside of counselling. I felt like there were so many things out there that they weren't talking to each other. So I started to look at occupational therapy and how we help kids regulate their emotions. Now, if you look at how we help kids regulate their emotions, it's all through movement and all through these sensory inputs. So like how they feel pressure on their joints or how they sense the world through their auditory sensation. And I started to get really fascinated about why is there this distinction between how kids do things and how adults do things.
So what did you start to understand had happened with your nervous system in that roller coaster accident back when you were 10?
When I was in the roller coaster accident, my body was flooded with these hormones, adrenaline, cortisol. It's like, here, you need to take action. You're in danger. But I was trapped, so I couldn't take action. So essentially what happens is when our body becomes overwhelmed by the challenge that's in front of us, it dips into that freeze response or that dissociative state. And this is actually a function of our parasympathetic nervous system. So it's an energy conservation state. And so essentially it's like, here, have all of this energy. And when that doesn't work, it's like, right, we need to conserve energy and protect ourselves. So we're going to increase this kind of pain reduction side effects of being in our parasympathetic state in order to protect you. So there are protective mechanisms. Ideally, we want to be functioning in that rest and digest state where we are connected and playful and curious and happy, but we teeter sometimes between these stress states of highly energized and low energy.
Anna, what role does the vagus nerve play in our nervous system?
Yeah, so you can think of your vagus nerve as essentially a communication highway between your brain and your body. So the vagus nerve runs down both left and right side from your brain stem all the way down to your abdomen. And its job is to relay information from your body to your brain and your brain to your body. Now, interestingly, it sends about 75% of information from your body to your brain and about 25% of information from your brain to your body. Now, what this means is that your body is constantly sending messages to your brain. Hey, I'm hungry. Hey, there's a bit of muscle tension here. Hey, there's something sitting in our gut that's not quite getting broken down that way. And then it ask the brain to enact change, hormonal changes, physical changes, biological changes, whatever it can to help. Now, what happens when we experience traumatic events or highly stressful or chronically stressful events is that communication system starts to get a little bit muddled. We start to send messages that aren't necessarily true, right? Like something's wrong with the body or something's wrong externally that we are getting these danger signals from, and we're sending off alert signals in our brain and starting this stress response when really that's not aligned with reality. The messages start to get muddled and they're harder to comprehend and understand. So low vagal tone, which is a weird way of saying just like your vagus nerve is not functioning optimally, can impact how your body communicates with your brain. So that connection between mind and body kind of becomes more and more difficult and more separate to one another.
So when our nervous system encounters a big threat, it typically goes into a fight, flight, or freeze response. In an ideal scenario, how is that recovered from? Like, how does the nervous system reset?
So I think the beautiful illustration of this was done through Dr. Peter Levine in somatic experiencing. So if you say watch an antelope get chased by a lion and it gets away, but it's been harmed maybe, or it's kind of gone into this functional freeze state where it plays dead and the lion goes off, you start to see this antelope afterwards, it starts to shake violently. So it looks like something's terribly wrong, but essentially it's shaking, it's shaking, it's shaking, and then it pops up and it runs back to its herd, right? Like nothing has even happened. And it just goes on with its life. And it's not like thinking about that lion, like it might be back. It's happy to be back with its herd.
So what's happening in the shaking? So what's it doing?
I mean, Sarah, have you ever been scared and then you've noticed that your hands will shake afterwards? This is a normal, natural response that we have for our body to start to regulate itself back down. So if you think of any time that you've been scared or anxious, that increase of energy if we're not running away from a lion, or we get an email, we're not like, run out of the room, then that energy has to go somewhere.
And by energy, it's like cortisol, adrenaline.
Yes,
it's all in our system.
Literally energy. So glucose is being released into your bloodstream. So you're having all of this cell energy starting to increase. So they're vibrating harder for you to take action. Now, that action in primal sense is to like run away or fight. But in today's day and age, it's like, well, I can't punch my computer. Like, I need that. So we tend to sit, we are still, we clasp our hands together. We don't want other people to see that we're stressed out or anxious. So that energy doesn't get utilized. And if we shake, we're embarrassed by it. We feel shame around showing other people that this is the state that we're in.
So if we don't discharge it, what happens to it?
So that energy will eventually start to kind of shape your nervous system, your fascia, in a way that holds a lot more tension. So it keeps you in a state that's kind of on and ready and hypervigilant. So for me, that shows up as like shoulder tension and lower back pain. I find it when I go to bed, I grind my teeth at night. Lots of people will go to physios and go, I have this unexplained tension in my body and I don't know where it comes from. And this is essentially like our muscles tense in order for us to take action. If that action isn't taken, then they don't downregulate. So if you are someone that does shake when you get nervous or scared, use that as a sign that your nervous system is actually downregulating itself in real time. And if you can actually amplify that, make it bigger and shake along with it, then you're actually giving yourself a really beautiful opportunity to close that stress response loop and come back down to that state of calm.
So I guess that's my next question. You know, if all of these things can supercharge our nervous system and we're not necessarily giving it the chance to release or come back into balance, well, what kind of things can we do to help? And do you have to do it in the moment?
So a lot of the time in 21st century society, we don't have the space to regulate in real time or work with our energy in real time. I hope this starts to change and it becomes more socially acceptable to do these things. But essentially, you can start to kind of create protocols that work for you. And I highly, highly encourage for people to start to explore these when they're not in a highly stressed state, because essentially when we're in a fight or flight response, we're not in a state that we can learn. If you're having a panic attack, Sarah, and I say, okay, well, here's the thing. You're going to start to do this and you're going to squeeze up here and you're going to hold your nose and you're going to blow really hard like you're doing a poo, but you're not going to like, it's a lot of information to take in and you're going to be like, stop.
This is not helping.
You're stressing me out even more, right? So we have to practice these outside of that state so that the more that we practice, they become integrated, they become embedded, they become tools that we actually know that they work, so that when we are in the moment, they're accessible to us. They're not something that we have to think about.
And what are some of the tools that you have found or people you work with have found to be effective?
So it depends on what state you're in. I think that's another really important thing. So what if you're in a freeze response, I wouldn't suggest doing the exact same resources that if you're in an anxiety spiral or in a fight or flight response. There's variation in how you want to work with your nervous system. So let's start with like the sympathetic state. This is a high energy state and you want to match that energy with things that you can do. So for me, that's movement. What movement can I do in this state that helps me feel that I can start to see that like subsiding of energy in my body? So for me, I love shaking and I would do this every morning because we have a natural cortisol spike in the morning. So I'll boil the kettle for my coffee. And while that's going, I will shake and put on some music and have a little dance party. But this also might look like going for a walk or running on the spot or doing some squats or finding something that works for you. So movement that matches your energetic state, and that sounds really woo-woo, but just the energy of your body is going to be really important in that moment. Once you start to feel that energy subside, then you can start to look at different techniques that help downregulate your nervous system even further. So this is a thing like physiological sighs, probably one of my favorite go-to breathwork techniques, which you essentially take two inhales through your nose and then one exhale through your mouth. So it looks like, and this is essentially mimicking how our lungs inflate every 5 minutes or so with an involuntary and inaudible sigh. And what this does is it kind of activates all of these different mechanoreceptors and baroreceptors in our lungs, which slow down our heart rate, lower our blood pressure, and dip us into that parasympathetic state. So most of the time, like before interviews, before anything that I have to do that's scary, I'm doing physiological sighs as much as possible beforehand. So it's a really portable and subtle tool that you can use. Other techniques that I and you and I were discussing beforehand was like an ear massage, massaging the lobe of your ears. The inner part of your ears is called the simbiconche, and this is where your vagus nerve is very close to the surface. And if you think about how we connect to people, how we connect through the voice is a really powerful way that we can get signals of safety, that it's okay for me to be here, that it's not a dangerous environment. So by activating our vagus nerve in our ear, we start to shift the way we're actually auditorily kind of taking in the environment, and that's like that sensory input that we're getting is very, very powerful as well. So gentle massaging of your ear, the earlobe, the inner parts of your ear is a really beautiful way that you can downregulate your nervous system. I mean, some of my absolute favorites for like long-term downregulation of sympathetic response is cold exposure. So something really interesting happens when we're exposed to cold, especially when cold water comes onto our like cheeks and our nose. So immersing your face in cold water is really powerful to do this. So we have something called the mammalian dive reflex. So this is essentially when we hold our breath underwater, all of our internal systems, so our heart rate, blood pressure, breathing rate, all of these slow down. So we can activate this mammalian dive reflex by putting cold water on our face. Now, the other thing that also occurs with cold exposure is like that acute cold exposure is going to make you gasp. So the first thing you do is, and then you start to regulate your breathing. And this is where the real power comes in. So you have that dump of like cortisol and adrenaline. You get your heart rate up, but as you start to regulate your breathing, your parasympathetic nervous system comes online at the same time. So you get this alert but calm state. So if you think of being in like a flow state of work or doing something that you love, this can be achieved through that kind of cold exposure as long as you are regulating your breathing throughout it. And over, they've done studies on this, over about 30 days of cold exposure, it actually lowers sympathetic activation and increases parasympathetic activation. So you're literally rewiring your nervous system to be more resilient to the challenges and stresses that are coming into your life.
So it sounds like what we're wanting to have happen ideally is that our nervous system can move in and out of different states of activation. It's not like we're always wanting to be calm because we have to respond to situations. It's about, can we move in and out of activation and in and out of rest?
Yes, 100%. You're spot on there. And I think the biggest maybe lie that I see nowadays out on social media is like, you can be calm with these techniques. And the result is not that you want to be calm, it's that you want to be resilient and flexible. And if we look at resilience as flexibility, I can rise to the challenge and then I can bring myself back down, then we have a much more functional way of navigating life, right? One that is far more compassionate because we're not demonizing, oh, so anxious or so stressed and bad Anna, I should have been calm that entire time. These responses that we have are necessary. Like, if you want sympathetic activation, if you want to laugh, that's sympathetic activation. If you want to engage in life in a really meaningful and playful way, that's sympathetic activation. Yes, there are stresses that are going to push us to our edge, but as long as we have the flexibility to not get stuck in that state and to downregulate, you are resilient and you can navigate these things. So I think the lie at the moment that I'm seeing a lot of is that we want to calm ourselves down. And I don't know if that's the kind of humans that we want to be, like these automatons that are just like super calm navigating a world that is like on fire at the moment. No, we want to be angry. We want to be responding. We want to be able to take action. But as long as we are not getting stuck in those states.
Anna, you dedicate this new book to Damien and Scout. Who were they?
So Damien is my husband, my partner in life. We have been together for a decade now, and Scout is our toddler.
How did you meet Damien?
Actually, at Muay Thai. We met at the gym and we sparred each other. And
is that metaphoric or actual?
No, literal. Literal. So just for reference, I'm 5'5" and Damien is 6'3". And we sparred each other. So I was quite aggressive. I was coming at him and he just stuck his punch out and punched me in the nose. And, you know, I just thought he was a really, really nice person. Like he was in a relationship and I was in a relationship, but we kind of just, we got each other. I didn't know anything about him. I just thought he was lovely.
He disappeared from the gym suddenly. What had happened?
So essentially we had both been going, Damien was kind of the staple there, I was the staple there, and then he stopped coming and I asked like around at the gym what happened to Damien. He had had a seizure at the gym and he was taken to hospital. Now I didn't have that kind of relationship with him where I'd like reach out and be like, hey, I heard you had a seizure, what happened? So I was kind of in the dark about what was going on for him, and it wasn't until we connected a few years later, we actually met again on Bumble and I reconnected with him, and Damien told me about what had happened, that he had a brain tumor, an oligodendroglioma, and yeah, just how his life had changed in a blink of an eye. He went from being 20, I think he was 23 at the time. He'd been working really hard as a welder boilermaker, a pressure welder, climbing up the ranks in that, going offshore, to then having brain surgery and like losing some of his function and navigating the world in this completely new way.
And what sort of prognosis was he given at that point at 23?
So at 23, the doctors had originally said that he had a few years to live. So originally they diagnosed him with an astrocytoma, but then after doing genetic testing, he was then reclassified as an oligodendroglioma. So the prognosis is very different for an oligo. It's a much slower progressing tumor, especially being a young, healthy male, like you have a lot of things on your side. So Damien didn't undergo any chemotherapy or anything for quite a few years after his diagnosis. He did radiation, but we didn't have, you know, when we got together, he was very clear, like, hey, I have a brain tumor. I just want you to know what you're committing to. And when I got with Damien, I was 23 and I was like, yeah, no problem. Like, we can do this together.
Really? No problem? It didn't give you pause?
I think that when I met Damien, I properly went on a date with him. I went to my friend's house afterward and I said, I'm going to marry this man. Like, that's how strongly I felt about Damien. I'd never had that sensation about anyone else before. And it was probably very, very naive, but I still feel that to this day. Like, I felt seen by someone for the first time in my life. Like, we talked out endlessly about everything. We challenged each other about everything. It was the first time that I felt someone push back and I felt myself grow intellectually because of it. And so that was something that I didn't take lightly. And I thought, you know what? Like, you and I can do this together. Like, we can figure this out together. That was naive, you know, like that I could crack the code on cancer. But that was what I felt like. Together we were invincible. We could figure it all out.
What did his prognosis, how did that factor in your conversations about having a family together?
Yeah, I mean, Damien was always hesitant for sure. And I think it was something that we had always wanted to have kids. I think the part that was challenging was that level of uncertainty, like we don't know what's going to happen and when it's going to happen, but nothing had happened for 8-9 years. And everything that had happened, we'd navigated it successfully and were continuing on. So I think we decided that, yes, this is something that we want to do. If we're going to do it, we're doing it together. And that, again, we can figure this out together. The highs, the lows, the messy parts, the good parts, it's all worth it for this relationship that we have and the connection that we have, and like bringing another soul into that space is only going to like energize us to work much harder to figure this out together.
And so that's how Scout entered the picture.
Yes. And she is full of life, that's for sure.
What's daily life like for Damien these days, Anna?
So unfortunately last year we had quite the experience. It was one of those It was one of those periods of time where you're like, is this happening to me? It's a very, it's traumatic when I look at it from the outside. So essentially Damien's seizures started to progress and get worse and worse. There was slight tumour progression and we decided that we weren't really getting where we wanted to get in Australia. We took Damien's medical care over to a clinic in Thailand. So they were doing metabolic therapies, which is essentially starving the tumour. And so everything was going fine. He was actually responding really well. His movement was starting to come back on his left side. But then unfortunately, he got an infection in his PICC line, which is basically a line that they put in to give IVs and medications. And from that point, it was downhill. His body was trying to fight off this infection. It was maybe caught a couple of days later than it was necessary. And the day that we ended up going into hospital in Thailand, I woke up, I went into the room, Damien looked at me and he said, "I'm sorry, I love you." And I broke down in that moment. I was like, something's seriously wrong and I think he's going to die. And so we went in the ambulance to the hospital and I've seen a million MRIs on his brain. To know that I was like spying through the door to look at the MRI and I saw this MRI and I was like, holy shit, like this is really bad. So where his tumour previously was very isolated to his motor cortex. It was very small. Now his tumour had basically, it was everywhere. It was all over his brain and his midline of his brain was being pushed from the left side to the right side. So it was intense. It was very touch and go. The doctors were great. They worked very hard to reduce all of the inflammation. The decision was made. I mean, I had to make a million decisions and it felt like I was playing God, which was terrifying. But I mean, miraculously, I stayed as calm as I possibly could throughout this because I didn't want Scout to be scared. I didn't want her to know that things could be as terrible as they like possible outcomes. So we ended up getting medevaced back to Australia and we actually arrived back on Damien's birthday and there was a series of unfortunate events and he was being actively palliated without any conversation with me. They gave him fentanyl because he was very uncomfortable, but obviously it put him into a catatonic state. And so from that, when they were doing his neurological tests and stuff, they said, there's nothing we can do. This was all without a conversation. I went and had a lie down for half an hour. I mean, ironically, it's always when you leave the room that things happen. And so I was like kicking myself that I wasn't there for it. But I found out about 6-8 hours later, they come in, they go, there's nothing we can do. And I'm like in shock because I was like, oh, well, why did we come back to Australia then, right? So it's his birthday. Everyone's saying goodbye. And I said to him, like I crawled up in bed with him. Everyone else was away for a moment. I said, hey, I need to be very honest with you. Things are not looking good. If you don't want to keep fighting, I get it. Like this is like you're exhausted. But if you do want to fight, you need to tell me that that's what you want to do. And he said, fuck yeah, I want to keep fighting. And I was like, right, I'm on it. And I was like, I've got to go. I need to go make some phone calls. But I'm on it, okay? We're going to keep fighting. And so I fought as hard as I could. I get on the phone and I'm like, no, we have to start giving him these certain medications that are going to help with this inflammation. And he needs to be on fluids at least because we can't be starving him to death. That's not humane, at least for us to figure out what we want to do. Essentially, I stayed on the hospital until eventually they said, right, we'll do a Hail Mary. We'll give him this medication to see if it helps. And within 24 hours, he was speaking again. He was telling people off. He was telling people what he wanted, what he didn't want. It was insane how quickly he switched. Now, I mean, day-to-day life now is very different, but he was on his deathbed. Now he can move. He's got hemiplegia on his left-hand side, so his left leg and his left arm aren't functional the same way that they used to be. He's doing lots of physical therapy, which is starting to help. But he has his own motorized wheelchair. He can get around. He's got semi-independence. We've got support workers. He goes to the pool. He's cognitively there the same way that he used to be there. Like, it's crazy to think that I mean, it depends on who you are, but that moment was like, you know, we could go two ways. And I felt like, again, playing God, like, I have a decision to make here. Like, I'm going to push for this person, or I'm going to let them go. And all I needed was that, yes, we're fighting, from Damien to go like, right, we're doing this. And it was just all system go from that point.
I'm so glad that you listen to him and he's where he is now. I think about, Anna, as you've described these events in your life, like when this trauma happened to you at 10, you had no idea how to handle it. The people around you were focused on your physical recovery, and it took years for you to sort of unpack. With this really recent, current, huge trauma that you're facing now as an adult and with your loved one, how are you approaching the emotional side of what you're really still right in the middle of?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think my approach is very different. And now, after being a practitioner for over a decade and understanding everything that I do now, I think there is a time to be in your emotions and to feel and unpack things, and there is a time to create a bit of space and distance. So that externalization of just day-to-day life is really important right now, especially when Damien was in hospital. It was just the momentary noticing of what's happening in my external world. So, for example, I was having a big panic attack one day on the roof of the hospital, and this butterfly landed in front of me. And it sounds so cliched when I talk about it, but for that moment, like, I could have just looked at it and be like, whatever, back to my panic attack. But I took the moment to actually just go, wow, like, the world continues on, and there is actual beauty that occurs, natural beauty that occurs. And for that moment, I gave myself a break from the experience that I was having. Now, I think we give distraction and that externalization a bad rap, but when you're in the thick of it and it's chronic and ongoing, you really do need to create space, because you're trying to problem solve something that's not necessarily going to have a resolution, right? And so how do you create enough space in your day, whether it's just for moments in time, to signal that, hey, things are going to be okay. Things might look a little different to how they would normally, or your future might look different to how you expected it. But in this moment, I can notice something that is beautiful or awe-inspiring or safe, that brings me back to earth for a moment, that gets me out of my head and into the present moment and into my body, to actually just be safe for this point in time. And I think those micro moments of external awe or not being in my own shit has been very, very grounding throughout this process. And I know at some point I'm going to have to face all of it. I'm going to have to work through everything that I have gone through. But now is not the time to do that. Now is the time that I need to be the lead of our family in regulating everyone else, in being calm and safe for other people to fall apart with. And my time will come to handle what I've gone through.
Anna, it's really fascinating work that you do, and I wish you and your family all the best. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
My absolute pleasure, Sarah. Thank you so much.
Anna Ferguson was my guest on Conversations today. Her books are The Vagus Nerve Reset and 21 Days to a Less Anxious You. This conversation was produced by Maggie Morris and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations episodes, head to ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.